I am a member of a group of about 50 men and women who are formed into something which is called the Greater Cleveland Round Table. These are largely people who are chief executive officers of major corporations, heads of the managing partners of the major law firms, mayor, chief of council, and the county commissioners, heads of our major universities, religious leaders, leaders of the minority communities, who meet together monthly to discuss the problems which confront Cleveland and to stimulate action insofar as they can through their own means and institutions. It's an interesting group. It has been in existence for about 2 years. It's not like groups of similar kind which exist in a number of other American communities. It took a major role in locating and sponsoring a slate of candidates for the board of the Cleveland school system for the last election and making possible their election. It was involved in the process by which community groups drew together so that when a new superintendent was elected and appointed for the Cleveland school systems, we wouldn't have the same kind of fiasco which has accompanied the appointment of a new director for the Metropolitan Housing. It's brought into being a group of labor leaders and of chief operating officers of the major corporations to discuss problems of labor management, employee-employee relationships. It has had an input, I love the buzzwords that we use, it has had action in the area of the enterprise zone. It's been relatively unsuccessful in the area of summer employment for young people, although it's gearing up for a major new attack on that problem next year. And the issue that I have been particularly involved in has to do with the whole human services, the whole public welfare program. I spoke to you a bit about it last week, none of my work, none of this roundtable's work, but of the problem itself. Essentially, this administration, when it came into power, announced a new structure for disbursement of funds for everything from public welfare to urban development. Its argument was that these funds coming out of the federal treasury have been organized and managed from Washington, and Washington is too far away from the people who are in need and from the services which are needed, and so it would be far better to channel this money to the states and let the states disperse these funds as they see the need, as they see fit. And so it was the government's position that some nearly 40 special programs ought to be amalgamated into 9 what they call block grants, and then most of these block grant areas ought to be transferred to Columbus and Albany to the state, and the states would then decide how much of the pot for this particular area of concern ought to. Population state like governors and the state legislatures. It saw this and the children of the unemployed. Then the anger of those who are the disbursement of these grants. And so we have our present in the anomalous situation of the legislature in Washington and of the administration having essentially brought into being the grant program, but the major transfer of these programs to the states or to local responsibility not having taken place. My special concern, and I began to voice it about a year ago and somehow became chairman of the committee to deal with this, had to do with the old-fashioned, parsimonious, antiquated way in which our particular state administration operates. By and large, in Ohio, we have not concerned ourselves with Columbus. Out of sight was out of mind. By and large, we have assumed that the major concerns, the major sources of money were in Washington. It's to Washington that our mayors and county commissioners went when they needed help for bridges or roads or people. But now the center of action will be in Columbus. And so far, Columbus has been a largely rurally dominated legislature and an administration which has been there for a long, long time, which has been involved primarily in giving advantages to industry and keeping taxes down, which is not an administration which has not shown any particular sympathy with or understanding of the complicated human needs of the large urban centers. And so we created a state liaison group, and we began at least to map out, to write a primer of how monies would be brought into Columbus and how they might be channeled in Columbus, where decisions would be made, what departments of the state government would make these decisions, who were the heads of these departments. And we circulated this information to all the major charities and social welfare agencies in the county and the city. We brought together their executive heads for a number of serious discussions. Out of those discussions has come a program which is now being submitted to the state legislature, which will attempt to take a great deal of the decision-making power away from Columbus and bring it to a more local source, the county itself and the city. But in the process, at least we have begun to recognize that all of us must take much greater interest in Columbus, that Columbus's power is going to grow, and that we can be very grateful that there will be, come January, a change of administration. This is all by way of background to a report which I'd like briefly to review with you this morning. The first knowledge of which you may have garnered from the papers about 8 or 9 days ago. And the Plain Dealer ran an article which said, survey shows possibilities of racial progress in Cleveland. The race relations group of this round table decided about a year ago to undertake a survey of race relations. Now, I must confess to you that I am something of a cynic about surveys generally. I don't think I share the old-fashioned superstitious belief that you ought not to number people. You know how the old Jews used to count a minion, not one, not two, not three, to make sure that the ayin hara, the evil eye, would not be focused on anyone. And it's interesting that the Bible reflects this kind of superstition. Apparently, sometime late in his reign for us, David undertook a census of his new nation. And shortly after the census was taken, a great plague, a fatal plague, struck a number of the cities in Judea. And as the 2 Samuel editors tell this story, they describe the plague as God's anger at David for having taken the census, for having gone 1, 2, 3, instead of not 1, not 2, not 3. But I do believe that most of these surveys, particularly attitudinal surveys, are simply quantifying the obvious, that they simply go out and give us numbers for what almost anyone who is aware of a particular situation would know through his own sensors immediately, instinctively. And furthermore, since Cleveland is one of the most surveyed and studied towns in America, I've learned long since that a survey is the excuse for action. It's doing something which does nothing when you don't know or are unwilling to do anything else. And so I was by and large not predisposed towards this survey, though I must confess I did not voice my concerns, because as in most cases when you're dealing with civic work, before these things come to the table for discussion, they're already decided on. In this case, the approaches had already been made to the Cleveland Foundation, to the Gunn Foundation, to the Schubert Foundation for the money for these surveys. And so the only question as you sit around. For action rather than action itself. A quarrel which is going on. To our universities and graduate schools, the whole question of employment, the boardroom to blacks. But this black agenda is really an agenda of those blacks who have already gained admission into the opportunity, which is America. It's a middle class agenda. And that the real problems which most blacks continue to face are the problems which most whites in the poorer classes are faced. It's a problem of class, not of race. It's the problem of employment, of jobs. It's a problem of education, of semi-literacy or functional illiteracy. It's a problem of welfare, of not having food, clothing, shelter, and not being able to go to a doctor to get medical service and the like. And that these are the problems which the black community ought now, along with everybody else, to be addressing. And so I think that this black leadership was concerned that focus again beyond questions of race, in order that everybody recognize that there's sort of a continuum of the race problem, that the problems of the black unemployed are in some ways harsher than the problems of others who are unemployed. The unemployment rate among black youth is over 2 times that which it is among white youth, that their concerns are not simply middle class concerns. So once the issue came to the table, holding of the survey was a foregone conclusion. It was conducted by a well-known firm of pollsters, Yankelevich, Skelly, and White, and they added a black pollster, Kenneth White, from Black Data, who is an educator who's had long training in this area. The most interesting thing that happened after the issue was tabled was the emergence of another group in the city who said, we want to be investigated also. And that's the Hispanic community, the Spanish-speaking community. By and large, we've thought in Cleveland that the issues of the other America are particularly issues of poverty and of race, and that race means black. But increasingly, the Hispanic community has spoken of its own special needs and of its own special problems, and they are emerging all across the nation as a major element in the political constellation. The Hispanic community of Cleveland numbers about 4%. It's still a small community. The census figures list about 16 million Spanish-speaking Americans in the United States who are citizens. There are countless millions of so-called illegal immigrants. It's estimated by some that if these illegal immigrants are given citizenship rights, and if the rate of immigration continues at its present rate, by the year 2000, the Hispanic community, however we denominate the Spanish-speaking community, may number one quarter of the population of the United States. So what we're talking about is the emergence into concern, into view, of a whole new political constellation who demand that their needs be looked at, that they be guaranteed representation, that their voice be heard, that they cannot be simply ridden over and forgotten about, even in a city like Cleveland, where their numbers proportionately are relatively small. And their issues are real. When the busing decision came down from the federal court, the integration decision a few years ago, the Hispanic community is listed among the white community. And there are on the west side of Cleveland several elementary schools and a junior high school where there are important remedial centers, where there are teachers who speak both Spanish and English, and where concern has been traditionally shown for the school population, which came out of Spanish-speaking homes, which needed people who could understand their particular background, the problems in learning English, the value systems that they came from, and give them the extra help that they would need in acculturizing themselves, assimilating themselves to American ways. Well, if, as originally the decision had been carried out so that these children would simply been bused across town and dispersed among a dozen or two other schools, this whole advantage that these youngsters had would have been lost. And I think that incident, more than any other, triggered the political energies of the Hispanic community, and they have become more and more vocal and visible ever since, and will continue to be. In any case, the survey has now been conducted, and as I assumed, the report is largely one which is obvious in its basic position. Cleveland, it turns out, is the 16th largest urban center in the United States. About 40 years ago, we were the 6th or 7th largest urban center. It's not so much that we have lost population, though our growth has been relatively minimal in those intervening 40 years. We've gone from about 1,600,000 to 2,100,000. But in other areas of the country, there's been explosive growth, and those cities and urban areas have passed us by. What is interesting is that since the survey was conducted during most of 1982, and all of us have been concerned with the problems of the so-called smokestack-based industry of Cleveland, the fact that we're heavily dependent on iron and steel and automobile-related production, old-fashioned industry, which is the first to be hurt in this slide, that Cleveland might be suffering economically more than most other cities. But it turns out that the median income of householders in the area is $22,000. Median income in urban areas elsewhere in the country is about $19,500. It turns out that in our urban area, there are about 8.2% who live at or below the poverty level. The national average is about 9.2%. So many other cities have been hurt far more than Cleveland. We've been relatively fortunate. And perhaps it's partially for this reason, perhaps for some others, the most surprising index that came out of this survey was that of general satisfaction with conditions in Cleveland. About 67% of those who were surveyed said that they were generally satisfied with life here. This compares with 57% who responded to a similar survey in 1977. So the satisfaction index has been increasing, growing here, at a time when it has been falling nationally. Now, of course, attitudinal surveys are surveys of one's feelings today, and people being what they are, they tend not to take a much broader look than that of their own immediate experience when they're expressing these their feelings. And what I think we have here is simply an indication that Cleveland slid into problems much earlier than most American cities. The Clevelanders got used to thinking of themselves as the mistake on the lake, as a national joke, as a place where you couldn't get bright young people to return or to come and settle. We looked upon ourselves as a city which was misgoverned. We went into default. A whole variety of attitudinal problems faced us. We became self-conscious about telling people that we lived in Cleveland because they might begin to joke about our city. And so, as other cities have fallen on hard times, as hard times came to Atlanta and Dallas and Houston, Cleveland has ceased to be the mistake on the lake. It has ceased to be the only national joke. And we've begun to look with clearer eyes at the advantages which we have. And when the people were asked about their feelings about Cleveland, they spoke of the fine recreational and cultural institutions we have here. They spoke of the quality of the school system outside of the system of the city itself. They spoke of the pleasure of living in a homely environment where family was the center of one's life. The black communities spoke generally favorably of the number of blacks who have won positions of leadership in the larger community, and particularly in the political life of the larger community. There was very little feeling in the black community that they were still being discriminated against at the union level, at the level of the hourly wage worker. There was a good bit of feeling that the mayor was a person in whom you could have great confidence, that there was a sense, therefore, of direction, of sensible leadership in the city. All these were pluses. And Clevelanders tend to feel better about their city than they did 5 years ago. That emerges clearly. Blacks, not as much as whites. But blacks feel 39% are generally satisfied with life in Cleveland compared to nearly 70% of the white population. What are the problems of the city? Problems of the city as perceived by blacks and whites are unemployment, crime, the school system, and police protection. And to a certain degree among the black community, the availability of housing. What about how do Jews fare in this survey? It turns out that we are the only community, a comfortable majority of whom rather happily and easily accept the whole concept of housing integration and racial integration. Twice the number of Jews accept the idea of blacks living in their neighborhood as non-Jews. And generally, the city would have no racial problem if it was a question of blacks and of Jews. The greatest degree of prejudice against blacks occurs among whites who come from Southern European ethnic origins. The second highest degree of prejudice is shown by whites who come from Eastern European origins. There's a very perceptible difference of opinion about blacks by those whites who live west of the Cuyahoga River compared to those who live east of the Cuyahoga River. No surprise in all of that. The one major surprise had to do with the whole question of confidence. The group that people in Cleveland have the most confidence in turn out to be people like myself, the religious leaders of the city. We show up very well among Protestants, Catholics, even among Jews. The second person, the group or person in this case, to receive high marks is the mayor. The third were the mass media. But here there was a marked difference. The non-leadership group that was polled had felt that the mass media were a responsible group in which they could, place confidence. The leadership group as a whole looked upon the media with very little confidence. And I guess that says something about how we use the media. Whether we read the sports page and the cooking page and the want ads, or whether we read the news. And there was a wonderfully perfect illustration of this in the report that the Plain Dealer made of the survey itself. The confidence issue in this attitudinal survey was done on the basis of confidence in various groups. The group that the paper is in was called the mass media. It was not, nobody listed the Plain Dealer. What was listed was the radio, television, and the press. And the press could be the Sun Press, it could be a whole variety of things. When the Plain Dealer came out with the story, the largest of the graphs that it ran was this confidence graph. And it showed the religious leaders and bars showing various things. It showed the mayor and the bars showing various things. And when it came to the media, it didn't list it media, it listed it the Plain Dealer. To show that everybody had confidence in the paper, and it did not list the low confidence bar of the leadership of the city. It listed only what it misrepresented, and then listed only what it chose to list. Those of us who read a newspaper carefully have good reason to have caution in our eyes, in our minds, whenever we read what appears there. But clearly, as far as an agency of building up attitudes, of changing attitudes towards various problems of the city, the media must be considered. They are the most important and the most effective way of dealing with the issues which face us. What comes of all of this? I'm not sure. Obviously, since none of this is surprising, what emerges is the need to continue doing what we have been doing. The issue, the basic issue, is the economic one. One out of every two blacks, one out of every three whites, I'm talking now of employed blacks and whites, is fearful of losing his or her job. Many people whose satisfaction, I should think, was still being measured are receiving unemployment compensation, which will run out at some point beginning now into next year. The city by itself cannot turn around the economy of the nation. There's clearly a need to create new jobs, and I think in Cleveland there's a clear need to recognize that many of the jobs that have been lost will never be replaced again. Much of our employment is structural unemployment. So unemployment in industries like the iron and steel industry, the automobile industry, which will simply not come back to earlier levels. And so one of the responsibilities of the business leadership of the town and of the entrepreneurs of the town is to create a new industrial base which is more technologically oriented, more oriented towards the new things in industry. And that's never been the strong point of local industry. We have spent less rather than more on research and development than most cities in the country. But clearly, that's the way, if we're going to have an industrial base here, that's the way things must go. As far as crime, it's a national problem. It's the problem which was shared by those who live in the suburbs and those who live in the city. The city tends to speak not only of crime, but of the sensitivity of police protection. The suburbs speak simply of police protection. There's clearly a need to deal with this problem, but how one deals with it at a time of massive youth unemployment, when one knows that the majority of crimes are committed by the young, how to deal with this at a time when the addictions are rampant in the society, and addictions are costly and must be fed, no one really knows. It's one of the unresolved social issues of the day. But clearly, the police must be sensitized and they must be encouraged, and people must feel some kind of security in their community to move about within it. The question of housing has to be faced in terms of both the dispersal, the openness of housing to all who can afford it throughout the community, and the availability of affordable housing to those who are on fixed and low incomes. They're not the same problem, but they are basic problems. Cleveland's housing stock is old, and the original housing stock was not very well built. What lies in the future? Obviously, there needs to be a whole new look at the question of public housing and dispersal of public housing. There has to be an opening up of the suburbs, particularly south and west of Cleveland, to those groups to which they have been traditionally unreceptive. And there has to be, or there perhaps will be, I don't know if there has to be, a redevelopment of areas in the center city, either in terms of gentrification, at least so that there's life in the core of the city where we live. As far as the schooling problem is concerned, of those who lived in the city, this was the next to crime, the number one problem. To those who lived in the suburbs, this was the greatest problem in terms of as seen from the city itself. The school system, I think, already has made strides towards improvement. It couldn't have gotten any worse. The two desegregation masters appointed by the courts were disasters. The desegregation decision, whatever its values may have been, and it was the law of the land, took away the concerns of the community from quality education to issues such as busing. And it's only in the last year or two that the children have begun to get a fair shake in the classroom. It's only in the last year or so that we've been able to put together a school administration which is concerned with the classroom and all the problems which the classroom represents. But clearly, if the city is to be viable at all, there must be a radical improvement in its educational system. There are still some nearly 75,000 children in the Cleveland public school system. It's still the largest in the state. And if it continues to spawn another generation of the semi-literate or the functionally illiterate, these will be people who will not be able to find their place in the far more sophisticated economy which is emerging. Now, these problems did not need a survey to be mentioned. We've known them for a long time. But clearly, they are priority problems. They are the perceived problems of the community, and they are the problems to which, on this local level, we must address our energies and ourselves. How shall I sum this all up? Perhaps with two quotations, one from Ecclesiastes, one from the prophet Isaiah. On the survey itself, is there something of which it can be said, look, this is new, it hath been said already? And on the need, wash you, make you clean, devote yourself to justice, aid the wronged. Amen.